Hey guys, so I thought today we'd just like hang out and catch up a little bit. There's no real news. Of course, I'm kidding. The Mueller report was released this morning. You are finding that out now. First, here on the Damage Report, I'm John DiRola, and we're going to be talking about it. I'll be breaking down some elements of it. We've also got Tommy Vitor of Pod Save America and Pod Save the World going to be joining us a little bit later on to give his take on it. But we have more stuff aside from that. We've got the president of National Nurses United, who's going to be joining us to talk about Bernie Sanders' most recent Medicare for All plan and why we need to transition to Medicare for All. She's going to be making the case for that from her expert position. And later on, we not only have news from around the world in our Meanwhile In segment, we have a massive Meanwhile In. We're going to try to cram as much news from around the world in as we possibly can. But before then, we got to talk about something. The Mueller report was released this morning, but even before the Mueller report came out, William Barr wanted a couple more minutes in the spotlight, and so he held a press conference. Now remember, William Barr put out the Barr memo about the Mueller report a couple of weeks ago, giving his interpretation, some of which has been borne out by what we found out today, and other parts have not been. But despite having a two-week lead in terms of his memo, he still wanted to give this press conference 90 or so minutes before anyone would have access to the Mueller report. Many people found that to be very suspicious, and once the actual press conference started, it became more and more suspicious for a couple of different reasons that I'd like to break down. One is that Robert Mueller was not at this press conference. Why do I mention that? Well, William Barr had nothing to do with the putting together of the Mueller report. He redacted it and all of that. It makes no sense for him to opine once again about his interpretations of the report when we already know what he thinks about it. Now, if he was to include Robert Mueller or anyone from the Mueller team, okay, maybe it would make sense that they would want to get out in front of the release of the report. Absent Mueller or anyone from his team, it seems like what I think it is objectively. It is PR done by a loyalist of Donald Trump who wants to once again determine what the narrative is going to be. Now, thankfully, I don't think that it worked in this case, because even as like his press conference was ending, we'd already had more credible reporting about what was going to come out in the Mueller report, and then the report dropped, and very quickly the headlines switched over to that. So I still have some criticisms of the Barr press conference I want to talk about, because I think it's important in how we interpret the Mueller report, and then we will turn to that. So first of all, he revealed that he gave advance copies of the Mueller report to the White House. Now, he said a couple of weeks ago that he would not do that, but he did. Why did he do that? Is it because it's in the best interests of the country, in the best interests of the people to understand what the report represents? No, of course not. It is to allow them to craft their response. And we know that Rudy Giuliani planned to put out a 30 or 40 page a response to the report, again, that they say fully exonerates them. And it sure helps to have a couple of extra days to do that when you have been given a copy of the report before the American people or any of our elected representatives actually have one. So that's awesome. He did reveal that there were 10 episodes of potential obstruction of justice, which we're going to break down in just a little bit. But his argument as to why there will not be any charges for obstruction of justice coming from the Department of Justice, that was really entertaining. I don't know, maybe you saw it. But he basically said that because Donald Trump was so frustrated by the ongoing investigation, when he would lash out doing things that seemed sort of obstruction-y, that was just him being frustrated with the process. And because there's not a corrupt motive, there's just the fact that he has the emotional stability of an ill-tempered three-year-old, you can't actually say that he obstructed justice. He was just triggered, that's all. This is almost officially the snowflake defense for the president. And in the future, if you plan on being president and you're going to attempt to obstruct justice, just make sure that you whine a lot while doing it, and then you will be free from any legal consequences for what you have done. Additionally, Barr says that you can't consider it to be obstruction of justice because the White House fully cooperated with the investigation, which is really interesting considering that Donald Trump never testified during the investigation when he's the principal person with information to provide about not only a lot of things that were going on during the campaign and afterward, but Donald Trump's frame of mind during those times. We never had any access to that because Donald Trump wouldn't testify, and we know at the time from leaks from inside of the White House that the reason he wouldn't testify is his team was terrified that if he sat down in front of Mueller, he would certainly perjure himself. Now, all of what I just said, that is full cooperation with the investigation, according to William Barr. Now, let's see. The emotional stability thing. Oh, also very important. There's no evidence from either what Barr said or my initial look over the Mueller report that they in any way looked into past financial crimes, money laundering, ties to organized crime, any of that sort of broader umbrella stuff that might possibly explain why Russia would be interested in Donald Trump or would themselves be crimes that could be investigated. There's no evidence that any of that was actually looked into or that if it was, it made it into the actual report. And what is also interesting about what Barr said is what Barr didn't say, because he repeatedly said no collusion. I think he said it four times, which is interesting because in the report, Mueller specifically lays out why he does not use the term collusion. He uses the term coordination and conspiracy, which are actual legal terms. Barr chose to use the terms that Donald Trump likes, not the terms that the Mueller report actually includes, which is certainly significant. And in his summary of that report, what he didn't mention is all of what actually came out of the report, which is important information from the point of view of Paul Manafort and Cohen and all of the others that were either indicted or charged or eventually pled guilty or already serving time. From Barr's point of view, if you were to just watch this and you hadn't been following the news for the past few years, you would think that nothing came of this, which we know, of course, to be a lie. So thankfully, people are not just going to pay attention to Barr and his press conference. Hopefully, they will also take a look at the report, which I also did. So let's get into that. One of the concerns before the release of the Mueller report was that William Barr, a loyalist for the president, was going to be doing the redacting of it. And our concern was that he might be overzealous in what he chooses to redact, meaning that we won't be able to learn much about what actually was found during the investigation. And I want you to take a look at some of these because it's interesting. The first thing I saw on page two, let's bring this up, is a part of the table of contents. Important section, Trump campaign and the dissemination of hacked materials. The first section was redacted for harm to ongoing matter. C is redacted for harm to ongoing matter. And it literally, C is between contacts with the campaign and WikiLeaks and WikiLeaks release of the documents. The thing in the middle of that is redacted. That seems significant, I think. Now, I understand, I guess, what the argument for redacting it is. It almost certainly has something to do with Roger Stone. Roger Stone is, still going through the legal process. That is the rationale they'll use. But it certainly seems significant that we won't be able to learn anything about that. Let's go to the next one. You'll see some more. This is about the release of the emails, some of the talk that was going on again. I mean, so much. Beginning in June 2016, harm to ongoing matter. Big section of it, harm to ongoing matter, right before WikiLeaks begin releasing the documents. I mean, that certainly seems significant. Perhaps eventually we'll have those details, but how many people will have moved on? How many people will have already had their impressions of what was in the Mueller report hardened through time by the time we actually get to that? Here are some fun pages. Let's see what you can make of them. That's a cool one. Looks like Tetris, kind of. That's Trump campaign and the dissemination of hacked materials. It says they showed interest and then it's all blanked out. Okay. I mean, I guess they were interested. I don't know what came of the interest. Nobody does because we can't look at it. Let's go to the next one. This is from page 52. That's a lot of black. You got some Rick Gates there, something, something, Paul Manafort. There's Assange, but I don't know anything else. And I understand that some people who already believe that they knew what was going to be in the Mueller report and aren't interested, essentially, in what's in the Mueller report will say that if you're complaining about redacting, it's because what's unredacted isn't satisfying for you. But I am a person who believes in transparency and finding out what's actually going on in the government and especially in the executive branch and especially in the White House. And so for me, it is extremely troublesome to have so much effort put into making it so that we can't make heads or tails of some of the most important parts of this investigation. That does not seem the slightest bit irrational to me. There's also a lot of information released in the Mueller report about the Trump Tower meeting. So let's bring up this first graphic. You see there that they're going to set up a meeting because of, quote, official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary. That was the bait that was used to get all of the top representatives of the Trump campaign to attend this meeting. It was presented as, quote, part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump. This has always seemed like how is this not attempted coordination when it is specifically described to you as the government's effort to help Trump while hurting Hillary? But anyway, we did learn a little bit more about that. So in terms of their messaging about that meeting. And you're going to see on several occasions, the president directed aides not to publicly disclose the emails that we just referenced, setting up the June 9th meeting, suggesting that the emails would not leak and that the number of lawyers with access to them should be limited. Basically, we don't want this getting out because it looks really bad. Before the emails became public, the president edited a press statement for Trump Jr. By deleting a line that acknowledged that the meeting was with an individual who Trump Jr. was told might have information helpful to the campaign, and instead said it's only about adoptions of Russian children. When the press asked questions about the president's involvement in Trump Jr.'s statement, the president's personal lawyer repeatedly denied the president had played any role. So they tried to hide the emails from coming out. When eventually a statement was going to be released, Trump Jr. did mention he wanted to in his first draft. He wanted to mention that there was talk of getting information that could be harmful to Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump then went in and overrid him. Then Trump Jr. added primarily to that, indicating that there were other subjects that came out. So here you have a coordinated effort, including Donald Trump's direct involvement, to stop us from finding out what was going on in the Trump Tower meeting. And again, none of that is obstruction of justice, despite the fact that he's trying to stop documents from getting to the investigators. They specifically said he had cooperated fully because he did not try to stop documents from being acquired by the investigations. And effectively, again, bear in mind a strain that will run throughout all of this, constant lying, which we're supposed to assume is fine because he was just frustrated at the time. So who cares if he's lying about documents or the purpose of a high-level meeting? He was just frustrated at the time. Now, what's really interesting from the point of view of Trump Jr., let's go on to this next graphic. This is a fun one. On the facts here, the government would unlikely be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the June 9th meeting participants had general knowledge that their conduct was unlawful. The investigation has not developed evidence that the participants in the meeting were familiar with the foreign contribution ban or the application of federal law to the relevant factual context. The government does not have strong evidence of surreptitious behavior or efforts at concealment at the time of the June 9th meeting, while the government has evidence of later efforts to prevent, unfortunately, we cut that off. The important part is already there, though. What they're saying is that Don Jr. isn't necessarily guilty of any crime because there's no reason to believe that he knows enough about the law to know that he was going to be breaking the law. So effectively, he's too dumb to be a criminal. That is what they're saying. And I really find it interesting that they stress that there's no evidence of surreptitious behavior at the time of the meeting. Well, yeah, kind of not, since nobody knew about it at that point. But as soon as it started to be revealed that something might be there, they began lying about it and continued to lie about it. And again, we're supposed to just pretend that that's totally cool and not a big issue. I still think it's a significant issue and one that certainly needs to be stressed and talk about this in the future. Okay, with that, we do have to stop for just a second. When we come back, Tommy Vietor is going to be joining us. We'll be talking more about the Barr press conference, the Mueller report, after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now to break down not only the release of the Mueller report, but other big news of the day, co-host of Pod Save America and host of Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Good to see you.
Great to have you here. You know, we had scheduled you to come on not knowing that today would kind of be a big news day. So kind of a good get for us. How you doing today?
I'm good, man. I mean, it's been one of those mornings where your jaw just, you're picking it up off the desk all day long.
Yeah, yeah, for a number of different reasons. So let's start to break down some of what happened today, starting with William Barr's press conference. During it, he said a lot of things that I take issue with, but he said specifically that the White House fully cooperated with the investigation. Now, I know you haven't had tons of time to read the entirety of the Mueller report and everything, but based on what we have learned, what do you think about that spin on Trump and the White House's behavior?
I mean, it's such a blatant lie that it's almost remarkable that he said it. First of all, Trump didn't sit for an interview about the underlying questions regarding collusion or a conspiracy with the Russians. He answered those via writing, but then he refused to answer written questions about the obstruction allegations. So he didn't cooperate with 50% of the inquiry. I don't know how Barr thought he could get away with saying that.
I guess he thought he could get away with it because he knows that the media tend to just eat up whatever he says and present it as fact. Many people aren't interested in whether Trump obstructed justice, and so they're willing to go along with whatever he said. And, I mean, look, he's being attacked, but I don't know that there will be any consequences. I don't think he's going to be forced out based on him mischaracterizing the report, unfortunately. And yeah, him not sitting to testify is, to me, it's one of those times that you wonder if you're taking crazy pills, that people can see that and think that Trump was being honest and forthcoming in this investigation. What else about Barr's press conference this morning stood out to you?
I mean, it is. We should step back and realize how remarkable it is that the Attorney General is out there spinning for the President of the United States, talking about his state of mind, making excuses for him. That is such a departure from what the Attorney General's role is supposed to be. Like when I was at the White House, I mean, we would never find out what was being deliberated at DOJ. For example, you know, Assange was just indicted. I learned about all those deliberations in the newspaper years later when Eric Holder started talking about it. Like, that's how it's supposed to be in a post-Watergate world. And yet you have Barr out there spinning and doing Trump's bidding. I mean, it is, you know, the fix was in when this guy applied for the job with a 19-page memo that said Trump couldn't commit obstruction of justice. And here we are. It's utterly predictable.
Yeah, there could not be a more obvious through line from his memo last year to how he's interpreting what is in the Mueller report on obstruction. And to that, let's turn to obstruction, because he specifically said that Trump had, in all these different things where some people might interpret it as obstruction of justice, he had non-corrupt motives. That, in fact, the only reason he did these things was because he was so frustrated with the investigation. And so, even if he did things that in other contexts might count as obstruction of justice, it doesn't count in this case because he's just emotionally unstable. What do you think about that precedent being applied to future presidents?
Or past presidents. I mean, yeah. I guess Bill Clinton was just, you know, kind of horny, and that's why he ended up doing what he did in the Oval Office. Is that an acceptable answer mm-hmm. for all the people who led an impeachment proceeding against him? I don't think so. It's not an acceptable answer to me, and I'm a Democrat. So, I mean, I think it is an astounding interpretation of the president being above the law. I mean, this country was founded on the belief that no one is above the law, and have the Attorney General out there spinning for him. It's just astounding. I mean, it's a side point, but Barr has spent more time briefing the press from the podium than Sarah Sanders or the Department of Defense press secretary has in, like, the past several months. So, you know, it tells you a lot about what this administration thinks about transparency.
That's true. And only because you mentioned Sarah Sanders, I just want to briefly touch on, it was revealed that she admitted to the Mueller investigation that she lied about James Comey and how unpopular he was in the FBI. I'm assuming this means that she's going to lose her job because she doesn't have credibility anymore, right?
Yeah, I mean, if the White House press corps doesn't walk into that briefing room with a set up plan where every single reporter is going to ask her about that quote until she admits it or ends the briefing, they don't deserve to have jobs.
Yeah.
Like, at some point, those individuals in that room, it's a waste of time. I don't know why they're sitting there. I understand it's part of the job. It is what it is, I guess. But they need to hold her accountability for lying to their face. It's now on the record, admitted in legal proceedings. They need to use this.
Yeah. So the difficult thing about news days like this is, you know, the report drops just a little bit before we're going to go live. I started scanning through it after personally OCRing it because the Justice Department didn't make it text searchable, which seems like a ridiculous oversight. And I began plucking out things that were of interest to me. But obviously, there are many things to be discussed. When you were initially, you're looking at it yourself, you're seeing what's being reported on social media and all of that, what are some of the things that stood out to you that you want to make sure that people don't miss in the flood of talk that'll come out of this release?
Sure, and forgive me for looking away and look at my notes here. A key point is Mueller failed at obstruction. I'm sorry, Trump failed at obstruction of justice because his staff wouldn't do what he said.
Yeah.
That, to me, is a remarkable key point. He's calling Corey Lewandowski, his former campaign manager, and he's trying to get him to call Sessions and slow the investigation down. He's calling Jeff Sessions at home and saying, unrecuse yourself. Those are blockbuster facts. If those are the kinds of things that were revealed in, say, Watergate and anything that the previous or any previous president had done something like that, it would be seen as an impeachable offense. So, like, the effort to obstruct justice was so blatant. The other thing that is astounding is that the Trump campaign had a 25-page proposal to try to get hacked Clinton emails, possibly from Chinese, Russian, and Iranian intelligence services. So there was this effort directed by General Flynn to try to get Hillary Clinton's deleted emails. What I'm trying to understand is, if you're to indict Julian Assange for almost exactly that this week, how is General Flynn or the Trump campaign not seeking some legal the problems for undertaking that kind of effort? That is another astounding thing that jumped out at me.
Yeah, and actually, related to the talk about conspiracy and all of that, there was a little section that said that it required the standard they were going to apply required a sort of formal agreement that you can't simply have behaviors on both sides that do benefit the other that fit the pattern of conspiracy. You need to have a formalized agreement, which, if that was the bar, it sounds like that was always going to be very difficult to prove.
What criminal is going to put their criminal conspiracy in writing? That is the dumbest threshold I've ever heard of for a criminal matter. I mean, and we also now know that Trump not only knew in advance about the WikiLeaks disclosures, they had a press plan that they were putting in place to maximize the impact. So that was something we debated for a long time. I mean, when you think back at how far this discussion has shifted, during the very end of the campaign and the month after, people who were trying to assert that there was a Russian conspiracy to disrupt our election were treated like they were crazy, like they were wearing tinfoil hats. That is like the second paragraph in the report, that there was a wide-ranging and systematic effort to disrupt our election by the Russian intelligence service.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you point out, you know, what criminal would be dumb enough to put this all in writing? We kind of have an example of something like that with the emails back and forth with Don Jr. before the Trump Tower meeting. As we pointed out in the last block, thankfully, from the point of view of the special counsel, it was so obvious that Trump Jr. is unaware of what is legal, what is illegal, that it would be difficult to prove that he acted with intent to break the law. But it was all there in the emails why he was going to attend that meeting.
Find me one kid on the street that gets to use the excuse, I didn't know that what I was doing was against the law, and then gets away with it. It is astounding. Okay, if your assertion is that campaign finance law is too complicated and arcane for the average person to understand, then why would any campaign ever seek to understand it or hire a lawyer? You have a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's amazing. And like Don Jr. was seemingly even worried about the degree to which his father directed the White House to lie about the reasons behind his meeting. Yeah. You know, if you're upsetting Don Jr.'s sensibility and morality, you crossed some lines here.
That is certainly true. And, you know, while we're talking about obstruction of justice, the second thing that makes me think that I'm taking crazy pills is, you know, we've all just accepted he fired Comey to stop the Russia investigation. And that's totally cool. You get one for free. It's on the house. You can fire one person. It was revealed that he ordered Don McGahn to fire Mueller and then told McGahn, okay, you refused to do it. Now I want you to lie about me asking you to do it. And that, too, even to Mueller, the guy he wanted to fire, does not necessarily rise to the level of obstruction of justice. Isn't that crazy?
I don't get it. I don't get it. I'm so frustrated by this. He told Don McGahn to fire Mueller to shut down the investigation, and then he tried to get him to lie about it, and McGahn wouldn't do it. And McGahn is all over this report talking about how absurd it was. I mean, the one of the key takeaways is, again, that Trump was attempting to obstruct justice every which way he could, and his team foiled him by not listening to him. I don't understand how that gets Trump off.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the bar is set so low by, you know, William Barr that he might just slide by. So, Tommy, thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully in the future we can talk about some other matters other than just this, but it is the big news of the day, and we appreciate you coming on to break it down.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun to vent.
Anytime. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, a little bit more, some conclusions from the Mueller report, and then we're going to turn to Medicare for All and news from around the world after that. Okay, a little bit more on the Mueller report. That's important, not only what's in the report, but what can come from the report based on a few graphics that I want to read you. Obstruction of justice seems incredibly clear if you actually read the Mueller report. I mean, we know so much about what Trump did publicly, obviously, but we also have some new information about what he was pushing for behind the scenes and why he was doing it. So let's talk about a couple different examples of this. Substantial evidence indicates that the catalyst for the president's decision to fire Comey, which was, of course, the impetus for the entire investigation in the first place, was Comey's unwillingness to publicly state that the president was not personally under investigation, despite the president's repeated requests that Comey make such an announcement. Now, that is not what Trump gave as his explanation. He said he fired Comey because of something to do with the investigation into Hillary Clinton. We know now that's a lie. So he fires the head of the FBI. He lies about why he does it. That apparently isn't obstruction of justice. We also find out that he told Don McGahn to fire Robert Mueller. And then when Don McGahn wouldn't do it, he told Don McGahn to lie about Trump wanting to fire Robert Mueller. That, too, apparently by itself does not necessarily rise to the level of obstruction of justice. And I'm asking a serious question here. If you can push to fire the person investigating you, and that is not obstructing justice, can you come up with something that is? Really? Like, what would he have to do? Would he have to personally exile Robert Mueller? And like while wearing a hat that says, I love obstructing justice, like how clear does it have to be? But apparently this is not enough. And it leads to the conclusion on obstruction of justice from the Mueller report. Because we determined not to make a traditional prosecutorial judgment, we did not draw ultimate conclusions about the president's conduct. The evidence we obtained about the president's actions and intent presents difficult issues that would need to be resolved if we were making a traditional prosecutorial judgment. They chose not to do that. At the same time, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, we are unable to reach that judgment. Accordingly, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. So that is what we knew, that last bit, from the Barr summary of the report from a couple of weeks ago. So they're saying clearly here that we don't want to work through the complex, all of the stuff that would need to be done to prove that he obstructed justice, but we are clearly not saying that he did not obstruct justice based on at least 10 different incidents that we break down in the report, let alone all of the public attempts to tamper with witnesses and all of that. Also, very interesting, maybe a sort of explanation why they don't feel it rises to the level of obstruction of justice. They say, the president's efforts to influence the investigation were mostly unsuccessful, but that is largely because the persons who surrounded the president declined to carry out orders or accede to his requests. And so, in this case, as with the Trump Tower meeting, attempting to do something is no longer any sort of crime. If you order your subordinates to break the law and they choose not to, you apparently haven't done anything wrong. If you try to coordinate with the Russian government to hurt Hillary Clinton's chances of winning the presidency, but it doesn't actually happen in that meeting, that doesn't actually count as a crime, which I think is news to a lot of people. But very interesting going forward, what needs to be done here. I'm not stating that the Mueller report is being clear that they are referring to Congress the need to resume this investigation or possibly impeach the president. But it's not difficult to read into this that that might be what he's doing. And here is an example of that. So he talks about what the standard for proving obstruction is. And he says about underlying crimes, which is something, by the way, that William Barr talked about a lot 2 weeks ago, saying that because they're not saying that there was a conspiracy with Russia, you can't have any other crimes related to it if there's no underlying crime. That is very clearly contradicted by the Mueller report in this section. Proof of such a crime, the underlying one, is not an element of an obstruction offense. Obstruction of a criminal investigation is punishable even if the prosecution is ultimately unsuccessful or even if the investigation ultimately reveals no underlying crime. The injury to the integrity of the justice system is the same regardless of whether a person committed an underlying wrong. And I just want to drive home all of the people who like took up the Barr summary and said, how dare you say that this could ever in any way be contradicted by the Mueller report? That is a direct inverse of what Barr said a couple of weeks ago. He said, I am not going to have any sort of referral for obstruction of justice because there's no underlying crime. That is directly against the legal theory and recommendation of Mueller right here. And Barr sort of alluded to that in his press conference today, saying that he disagrees with Mueller on his legal theories. And isn't it a strange coincidence that the way he disagrees is consistent with a 19-page letter that he put out as his audition for this role last year? William Barr was brought in because he does not believe that obstruction of justice is a real thing or that it can be prosecuted. And even though Mueller clearly says that you can be prosecuted, even if there's no underlying crime, William Barr doesn't think it rises to the level, which is really interesting. And there's another section that talks about the separation of powers. And it says in that section that Congress, if it feels is necessary, it will not be sort of contradicting the constitutional powers of the presidency for them to investigate or have charges over obstruction of justice. And I have a feeling that you're probably going to see that talked about quite a bit as some Democrats in the House push forward based on that underlying argument. So again, there's so much more that I wish that we could get to. Unfortunately, we're already over, so we're going to stop for now. When we come back, Medicare for All, we're going to break it down after this. Joining us now to talk about Medicare for All and Bernie Sanders' most recent plan that would make it a reality is Deborah Berger, president of National Nurses United. Deborah, welcome to the Damage Report.
Good morning. It's good to be on. Thank you.
We're very glad to have you here. So before we jump into Medicare for All, can you, for people who might not be familiar, can you talk a little bit about National Nurses United and what it, how it works?
National Nurses United is the largest professional nurses association and the largest all-registered nurses union in the country. And we have had a progressive agenda of working for social justice, climate justice, economic justice, and healthcare justice for decades.
And so from the point of view of National Nurses United, from a nurse's point of view, why is Medicare for All something that you're interested in?
Medicare for All is something that we've been interested in for decades because we're at the bedside. We're at the front line where we see patients harmed because they don't have access to insurance and health care. They often are having to make immoral choices on whether they pay the rent or get their chemotherapy. And we believe that healthcare is a human right, and we really need to move that issue forward. And it's moving.
It certainly does seem to. I mean, when you look at polls of Medicare for All or alternative plans like that, it's very popular. There are also, of course, multiple different ways that you could get to Medicare for All or some other form of single-payer health care. Bernie Sanders' plans, which he's updated recently, what do you make of those?
His is the gold standard. We've worked with him for decades to make Medicare for All an issue. He put it as front and center in his presidential campaign. And we joked with him by saying that he actually adopted our agenda for healthcare for all. So we're really excited that he's submitted the bill again this year.
So you've got on the one side, you've got National Nurses United, some politicians pushing for Medicare for All, which is becoming increasingly popular. You do have pushback from the other side, though. I saw yesterday the CEO of, I believe it was United Health, saying that Medicare for All would destabilize healthcare in the U.S. Well, I imagine nurses would know if that was the case. So are you concerned that it might destabilize healthcare?
What it's really going to do is destabilize the insurance industry's profits. It's not going to destabilize healthcare at all. In fact, it's going to make it better and more accessible for every single American in the United States.
So from the point of view of your organization, what are some of the main issues, the systemic or personal issues with healthcare access and health insurance that you think need to be addressed most urgently?
Most urgently is the fact that Americans are paying for health care insurance, but they don't actually have access to real health care. They have copays and deductibles and premiums that prevent them from actually using the health care insurance that they're paying for. And we know that this bill, along with the bill by Pramila Jayapal, will actually address those issues.
So one thing that I think you could be really helpful in is I know that you have Bernie Sanders and others who want Medicare for All. You have a lot of other politicians that are also saying they want something like Medicare for All, or they have a plan that they're calling Medicare for All that differs in some significant ways potentially with someone like Bernie Sanders. When you're looking at these other plans, or you're listening to these other politicians talk, what are warning signs that they might not mean the same thing as someone like a Pramila Jayapal or a Bernie Sanders?
The warning sign is that they leave the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies in charge of deciding who gets health care. Mm-hmm. When you talk about rationing of health care, when you talk about denial of health care, it is actually the insurance companies that are doing that job. And we don't need a middleman that actually interferes with the access to healthcare and interferes with the job nurses want to do in the United States to provide healthcare for every living resident in the United States.
Well, one of the big differences that I see between some of the different plans is some would eliminate private health insurance as an alternative to this plan, and some would maintain it on the side as an alternative if someone wanted. From your point of view and from the point of view of National Nurses United, what do you think of those two competing ways to do this?
When you really look at the issue, the real problem is that people won't have true access to unfettered relationships with their doctor if they leave in place private insurance companies. This bill doesn't totally eliminate them. They can find other niches to market some type of healthcare insurance, but leaving them in place really does not benefit anyone. And I think that that's probably where we all differ is allowing insurance companies to have a say in how we get our health care.
Well, and I'm sure over the course of the next few months, we're going to see quite a few debates with a lot of questions about this issue. We're going to see how these different candidates would get us to Medicare for All or something like it. And I'm sure you will be watching very closely. Deborah Berger, President of National Nurses United, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, and we'll be continuing to work on Medicare for All.
I hope so, and I hope you have someone in the White House who will help you along with that.
That would be helpful.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here. We come back, news from around the world, and meanwhile in. While U.S. media is perhaps rightfully focused on the Mueller report today and for the next few days, there is a lot else going on around the world, and we turn to it now in a segment we call Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in the oceans, plastic is apparently an even bigger issue than we thought it was. And here on the Damage Report, we thought it was pretty bad. We talk about it quite a bit. So apparently, while traditionally investigations of the amount of plastic in the ocean focuses on so-called microplastics, very tiny particles of plastic, the amount of big pieces of plastic has been rapidly increasing as well. The increase in large plastic pollution has been happening since 1957, with a significant increase since the 1990s. There's a new study that talks about the overall impact of plastic production and dissemination around the world and how bad it's going to be. That study is available in the journal Nature Climate Change, found that if the trend that's been identified continues, the making of plastics will comprise 15% of greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. By comparison, all of the world's forms of transportation now account for 15%. Of emissions. So we talk about plastic once it's been made and once you use it and once you throw it away, but the actual construction of it is also really bad for the environment. And in particular, I love these campaigns to get people to take more personal responsibility for their waste and their emissions and all of that. One example of that is plastic straw use, and you see more and more people making an effort to not use straws. That's great, but straws make up a very small percentage of the plastic that is produced and the plastic that ends up in the oceans, whereas fishing nets and things like that is a significant percentage. I get that that's harder for us individually to do anything about, but it should perhaps be a bigger part of the conversation to push the government to actually do something about it, because that's significant as well. And sort of getting into that, I want to talk about a quote from the chief policy officer for Oceana, who said, individual action can help, but we don't want the individual to feel like they are the problem. What we really want is for companies to give us choices of more plastic-free products or products that can be reused or refillable. We need to change the structure of our commerce to protect our marine health and our own. And that's what's always so interesting about this, is that we talk about individual use of plastic. We don't talk nearly enough about the use of it by manufacturers in producing these products in the first place. And that is something where the government could very much be more involved. Meanwhile, in... Meanwhile, in the UK, a long-awaited porn ban is set to be instated. It's been coming, but you won't be. I feel uncomfortable even making that joke, so I apologize. So let's turn now to the porn ban. There's new checks to make sure that the only people who will be able to access porn will be above a certain age, to make sure the kids don't see it. Those checks could include having internet users enter personal details into a privately owned database or buying a pass from news agents. There will be a number of different ways for people to prove their age, the government said, all of which will be, quote, rigorous, and are not simply typing in a date of birth or ticking a box. The Internet Service Providers Association said that internet companies may be asked to entirely ban websites that don't comply with the rules, but that it expected most pornography providers to do so. And on the other side, I guess, you have digital rights campaigners strongly attacking the new rules, arguing they represent a severe limit on the way the internet works and could compromise the privacy of people who cooperate with them. And also, hypothetically, I mean, the websites might be more inconvenient for people outside of the UK if they have to continually be saying how old they are to comply with UK rules. This is dumb. I'm not saying that there isn't some case where some of the more extreme forms of porn perhaps are not suitable for 10-year-olds to be seeing. I get that. It's pointless, though. I mean, back in the day before the internet, to see porn, you had to physically buy an object. That's way harder for an 8-year-old to do. You can't even, like, stack 3 8-year-olds in a trench coat and get them to do it. They'll see through that. You had to physically hand over money and physically be given an object, and still kids found porn. They were able to get it then. They're going to be sitting in front of this computer with a great incentive, if you know what I mean, to get past these things. You don't think they'll be able to do that? I'm continually asked how old I am. I frequently lie, even though I'm old enough to qualify for anything. Kids, too, will find a way. In the end, it's likely to just inconvenience people who are legally able to see the porn without doing much to stop kids from accessing it. We'll check in a while and see if maybe I'm wrong. Meanwhile, in... Meanwhile, a world leader is taking drastic action to call attention to the oceans, which is, of course, the focus of Meanwhile in today. Actually, going deep below the ocean in a submersible to call attention to how much damage is being done to it. That is the president of the Seychelles, Danny Faure, who implored the world to do more to protect the, quote, beating blue heart of our planet in a Sunday speech broadcast live from the depths of the Indian Ocean. According to the AP, it was the first time a political speech has been broadcast live from a submersible underwater, although I'm sure Beto O'Rourke will do it later today, now that the precedent has been set. The Seychelles president said the ocean is huge, covering almost 70% of our planet, but we have managed to seriously impact this vast environment through climate change, ocean acidification, overfishing, plastic, and other pollution. And in terms of the overall protections that have been provided after decades of activism, only about 5% of the world's oceans are currently protected. UN member countries have agreed to increase that percentage to 10% by 2020, a goal that won't likely be met. But even if that target is reached, it won't be enough to ensure the health of ocean ecosystems and maintain their biodiversity, especially because you can say that this particular section of the ocean is protected, but climate change is heating up all of the ocean. You can't control that in a local way. It takes a world's effort. It takes much more than a village, it turns out, in this case. But still, for the president of the Seychelles, anything you do to draw attention to this, I'm in favor of. We will see where he'll broadcast from next time. And I will also point out, after tons of efforts at broadcasting live from different locations and having lots of trouble at it, the fact that he can do so deep below the ocean is an indictment of the technology here at TYT. Anyway, with that, meanwhile in... Meanwhile, in Iran, or at least concerning Iran, their control of women and what women are able to get up to is causing problems in women's athletics as well, with Sadaf Kadem, the first Iranian woman to compete in an official boxing match, saying she won't return home to Iran after learning about an arrest warrant issued against her coach, because, of course, the you know, over the overall effort to control female behavior is now impacting people associated with those women as well. She said, "My trainer got information from Iran that said a warrant was issued for his arrest. I could make my choices, but not put into danger the people who have helped me so much." In terms of her her sports activities, she says, "I wore the flag of my country high. I fought with courage. I won. I honored our national anthem. Yet the Iranian Boxing Federation let me know that, quote, this fight does not concern us. In which country in the world does honoring your homeland lead to an arrest warrant?" We are unfortunately out of time. I wish that we could talk more about this, but we'll see you tomorrow with a lot more.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.